Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with crime novelist Greg Herron, author of Royal Street Revillon, and Gene Redman, author of Not Dead Enough. It's a real pleasure to welcome Gene Redman and Greg Herron to The Reading Life. They're both celebrating new books this month. Longtime friends, they both work at Crescent Care, both are leaders in LGBTQ fiction, and appear at the Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival each year. And both have long-running crime fiction series set in New Orleans. Gene's new book is Not Dead Enough, which has a complicated plot to go along with that provocative title. It's the 10th in her series, featuring private investigator Mickey Knight. And Greg's new book is Royal Street Revillon, the 8th in his Scotty Bradley series. Greg loves Christmas, I think. Gene, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm so happy to see you, Greg.
Are you really?
Oh,
you'd be the only one.
I know. Now, you two both stake out New Orleans as your turf, but your characters experience it very differently. So, Gene, you start off and tell us a little bit about Mickey, and she's struggling a bit in this book, really.
Well, she's struggling in most books because, let's face it, the books where everyone's happy and content aren't that interesting. You have to have some sort of conflict. You know, you take segments of characters' lives, and that's the book you write about. You know, all the other stuff that goes on in their lives, you know, because presumably if they're real-ish people, they have real lives, but you're not telling, you know, we never see our characters do the laundry. We never see our characters go to the grocery store very rarely. So that stuff is all cut out. So yes, she's an interesting character because, like many of us, you know, life is a constant sort of churn and change. Mm-hmm. And so that's what interests me in terms of, you know, how do I write about this character? How do people who are flawed and messed up, contradictory, ambivalent, how do they search for justice? How do they figure out how to do the right thing? And that's what interests me as a writer.
And when you're dissecting New Orleans, you're often doing it in terms of class and money and marginalized folks.
Right. Well, power often leads to the kind of crimes that I'm interested in. It's often the abuse of power. Mm-hmm. And also looking at it that way. And of course, you know, my day job, as you mentioned, that's a lot of what the work we do is. So I think that both Greg and I see in New Orleans that a lot of the tourists don't see. And it's just as valid New Orleans as the one the tourists do see. And I think sometimes it's important to look at what are the things that rip us apart. Mm-hmm. And how do we look at, you know, ways that we can bring them back together again?
Well, Mickey's new case is a very interesting one, and I think we can say this without spoilers. It turns out to be about a group of women who are trying to gain independence and power.
Well, again, it's about, you know, how are the power structures? When I started writing it, I originally thought, you know, am I going over the top? Am I doing, I'm going to, you know, back into the 1950s and some of the attitudes toward women. And then real life, hello, came sort of to roost in the newspapers and stuff. I'm like, no, clearly I'm not. Clearly this is still a huge battle that we're having of who gets to be human, who gets to make their own decisions, who gets to be the handmaids to other people. And, you know, what are the tensions there? Yeah, and of course, Mickey's on the side of you get to be human, but it becomes messy because some of the will is also desperation. Some of these women feel very trapped and don't always do the things that they should do, which makes it complicated.
And to amp up the desperation, you've set your story in New Orleans in August, and it is very atmospheric. There's more sweat in this book than any book I have ever read.
Well, you know, New Orleans is a character, and the seasons of New Orleans are characters, too. And certainly summer has its own oppression. And I wanted to try and give people the sense of what it's like to be in New Orleans in the summer.
Well, that gap between the air-conditioned house and the car and waiting for the AC to kick in
well,
when you're driving.
Am I right or am I right?
You are absolutely right. Now, Greg, in your book, Scotty is on an upswing, captivated as he is by a reality TV show called The Grand Dames of New Orleans. And then things get darker. So talk a little bit about this setup. You have been fascinated by The Real Housewives.
Oh, I love The Real Housewives.
I know you do.
I love The Real Housewives, which I never really thought I would. I never thought reality TV would be something I would be interested in. I originally liked the competition shows, like Project Runway. And that was my gateway drug, because that was Bravo. Which is Real Housewives country. And I actually used to, on Sundays, would be my day to read. I would just sit in my easy chair and read, and I'd need background noise, and I would just turn the TV on, and I would just put it on, like, Bravo, because it would be inside the actor's studio for a few hours. Then it would go into a marathon of some Real Housewives show. And I found myself getting really oddly vested in these people. And which I don't understand, because they're all awful. And then I thought it'd be an interesting way to write a mystery, a murder mystery around a show like that, because how much is what's real and what's not real? What's scripted and what's not scripted? Because the idea is that these shows are unscripted, but they're clearly scripted.
Oh, of course.
When the camera crew's there inside already, when the person comes to the door, it's like, oh, I had no idea you were coming over, but I just happened to have this camera crew here in my foyer.
And yes, are you at this party?
Yeah. It's like, So I thought it would be an interesting thing. Paul and I, my partner and I, one gloriously funny Sunday afternoon, cast a Real Housewives of New Orleans. And who would make it interesting, and we know a lot of really interesting women in New Orleans, and we were just laughing hysterically, but none of those people would do a show
of
like
not.
The Real Housewives. Would you, Susan?
Now, Greg. Now, I have to say, your Scotty has had a pretty charmed life.
Yes.
He's had accepting parents. He's got no financial worries. He's in a love triangle that keeps him pretty busy and supplied with great sex, as you make a point of saying over and over again. So he's kind of living the good life in New Orleans.
Yes. I kind of wanted to do... It's so hard to imagine that it's been so long since I wrote the first book in this series, but it was a different world when I wrote the first Scotty book. And I was really, really tired of reading gay books about miserable people. And I wanted to write a book about somebody who had absolutely no hang-ups about being gay, had no issues with it, had no family problems with it, who, whenever confronted with homophobia, would be completely caught off guard because he's not used to it and didn't know how to deal with it and or react to it. And he was kind of a nice guy. He was a lot of fun to write about. and he had a good sense of humor. He approaches everything, even the most insane things that happen to him. He always finds a way to laugh about it or make a joke about it or, oh, here we go again.
Or just plain cope.
Yeah.
Dead body in the living room? No problem.
Not this again.
Right, exactly.
That's his attitude.
So, but you've stayed with him for 8 books now. So talk about that long-term process of getting to know him and seeing him change.
I don't know that he's... It's funny that you say that, because I write these books so by the seat of my pants, really, because that's just who he is. He doesn't like structure, and he doesn't like plans, and he doesn't like stuff like that.
He zigs, he zags.
Right.
Yeah.
He's just not, that's just not who he is. His life just happens to him. And so I kind of have to write the books that way, which is really problematic, because it's been so long since the first books that I don't remember things that happened in the first books. And so I have to go back and look things up. And I always been told if you're writing a series, you should have a series Bible that has all the details and all of that stuff in it, but I'm too lazy.
True confession.
So I just went through, I have a stack of the whole series and there's just post-it notes and they're color-coded. It's like, okay, that's his mom. This color's his mom. This is him. This is his brother. This is Frank. This is whoever. So if I need to verify something, it does make it a little bit easier, but I don't remember the book that it was in, so I have to go through all of them. So it's, I really do need to sit down and do the Bible.
Someday you will.
Probably not.
Now, Gene, you've stuck with Mickey for 10 books. So what is that enduring appeal, that relationship you have with her?
You know, I always figured that for, with a series, you keep writing the books as long as the character's interesting, as the character has places to go, as you find a story. And it's always that struggle of how do you make it work? How do you make it, you know, so one of the reasons I made her a private eye is that people walk into her office and they give her cases. Mm-hmm. And of course, she lives in New Orleans, so, you know, bodies fall out of the sky as well. You know, one of the first questions I asked myself when I started the series is, and, you know, way back in 1990 was the first book published, is what kind of woman would become a private eye? Mm-hmm. What kind of woman would walk, you know, walk the proverbial mean streets and you know, do this sort of stuff? And so I realized that it's probably not the person from a nice, sunny, middle-class household.
Right, right.
And that's why I thought, okay, what kind of backstory would this woman have? And so that's when I, you know, I'm not going to go through the whole, you know, the books, but it's about, you know, she's struggling with a lot of things, you know, did not have a great childhood. Right. And I think one of the things is when you do not have justice or fairness at an early age, you keep looking for it for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of her struggles is how do you do this? And so that's one of the things that has kept it interesting for me is, you know, what she's struggling with now. You know, where is she? What kind of story would she be in that would be pertinent to where she is? And so far, I've been able to figure out things that I, at least are interesting to me, and I hope continue to be interesting to the readers of the series.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with crime novelists Greg Herron and Gene Redman. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm with Greg Herron and Gene Redman.
I get the sense in both your books that, you know, you have always have a subtext of educating your readers about LGBTQ life, about healthcare. It's woven in really nicely.
I never consciously saying, oh my God, I've got to tell all the straight people about us. It's like, this is the life that we live.
Right.
This is just how, you know, gay people live their lives. You know, I've read the books where someone has put in a gay character and there's one gay character in the book. And like, no, even in the small towns, the gay characters know the other gay people in town.
Right.
I mean, you just sort of do it. And, and it's, you know, it's dominant culture and subdominant that people in the dominant culture, you know, the straight middle class white, yada, 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 are very much aware of it in a way. And those of us in subdominant cultures are aware of it as well because we have to live in it pretty much on a daily basis. But we also live in our subdominant cultures, you know, whether you're a disabled person, a person of color, you know, LGBTQ, you live in a kind of different world. And what I'm doing is I'm just writing about that world. If it's educational, great, but that's not my intent. My intent is simply to be a witness and to describe the kind of world that my characters live in and, you know, the things that they run into on a regular basis.
And your characters do, I have to say, think about health a bit. I wonder why. I mean, since you both work for Crescent Care, which is admirable beyond belief. Now, you're both published by Bold Strokes Books, and you're both really prolific. So tell us a little bit about that publishing company and give me a sense of your readers, what you hear from your readers.
I've really enjoyed the Bold Strokes experience for the most part. I mean, every writer is going to has complaints about their publishers. But it's been, overall, it's been a very pleasant experience. I've really loved all of my covers. I like the way they pretty much will let me write anything I want to, which is an unusual experience, which has been very, one I'm very, very grateful for. As for being prolific, that was kind of an accident. What I used to do with my previous publishers was they would email, my editor would email me and say, what are you working on anything? What do you, you know, let's get me a proposal for something. And then I would just write up like, here's five books that I want to write with a title and a description. And they would always say, okay, well, we'll take the Scotty. We'll take the chance. It's like, all right, fine. And I did the same thing when I went to Bold Strokes. They sent me an email after my first book came out asking me what I wanted to do next. And I sent them a list of like six or seven books I wanted to write. They wanted all of them.
Be careful what you wish for.
They replied with contracts and due dates. And then once I got on to that, I was like, well, when are you going to get this opportunity again? And finding a publisher who has enough faith in you as a storyteller to let you take chances with stuff unlike the Scotty series that are completely different from what you're known for and not be too worried about the brand, which I hate being a brand. That just bothers me. But it's been a really pleasant experience for the most part. They even let me pick out my own font.
Oh, nice. Fonts are so important.
I can't read a book if I don't like the font.
I didn't pick out my own font. That's not fair. I'm going to check my contract. I think it's, you know, they've been a very good publisher. They're actually do it as a business. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you have the smaller publishers that are focused on communities, they tend to look at it as a cause. I will not name some previous publishers that I've had in the lesbian feminist world that were like, well, you know, I'm sorry we didn't give you your German royalties, but we needed the money.
Oh, no.
Yeah, well, that's why they're not a publisher anymore. But, you know, so it's been, you know, and I've had a fair number of publishing experiences through my career, as has Greg. You know, we've both been in the quote-unquote larger mainstream publishers. And, you know, LGBTQ just doesn't sell enough to stay in them. So it's very lucky and privileged to actually be continually published. And that's something I'm eternally grateful for, because people say, you know, can I get your books? And I'm like, yes, you can.
And people have such terrific loyalty to your books. I mean, I remember seeing on Facebook the other day, oh, I'm so glad Karen's back, referring to a character who'd returned in your most recent book. And so you obviously have reader loyalty, you know?
Yes, I do. And some of them have really commented on the arc of the, you know, and I keep trying to say, I am writing a mystery series, not a romance series.
I warned you about that.
Oh, I know.
Now, you two have done some editing together of anthologies. Talk about how that
has... We
still
talk to each other. Isn't that
you do. I know. It's amazing. Well, talk about how that sharpened your skills and what you learned from it.
I became an editor by accident, literally. I got a job in a magazine, and my original job was to simply find content, not edit it, but just to find content and assign. It was a queer book review magazine, and assign books to people to review and follow up and make sure they turn the reviews in. And the editor actually dealt with all of that stuff. Well, she left after I was there for 3 months, and then I became the editor, and I was doing her job and my job at the same time, but it was a lot of fun, and I was enjoying it. And from there, I got offered, my first publisher that published my first novel asked me to edit an anthology, and I had no idea how to edit an anthology. I had no idea how to do it. So I started editing, and the first anthology that I edited from them was like their biggest selling anthology ever. It's
high bar.
And it their anthologies generally went out of print after the first printing, never went into a second printing, and were usually unavailable within 2 years. Mine was still available 8 years later when the publisher went out of business.
Wow.
And I was still getting money from it, which was astonishing to me.
Yeah.
And because of that was so successful, they asked me to do another one that was also really, really successful. And then other people wanted me to do anthologies. I've done over 20 now, and I still don't know what I'm doing. But it works.
Yes, you do. You know what you're doing on some level. What was it like to work with this one?
Oh, good Lord. You know, the vodka was my friend. No, I'm kidding. You know, I think the thing that works for us is neither of us are incredibly persnickety, egotistical people. Mm-hmm. And I think we both understand, you know, he works, I work, we have multiple different things. And so it's like, let's figure out how this works. You know, you do this. I did most of the stories submitted by the women. He did most of the stories submitted by the men. So we're able to really kind of work it out. And you know, Greg may have been cursing me under his breath all the time, but I didn't know it. You know, it was a fairly easy working relationship.
And this was the anthology Mean Streets, am I right?
The two Mean Streets anthologies, yeah. And we did a horror anthology together as well.
Yes.
Actually, I'm incredibly difficult to work with, actually. And working with Gene is incredibly easy. I was a little nervous, to be honest, because I've seen friends do work together
who, oh, yeah.
you know, go south. But it was really remarkably easy because one of the things that Jean's a really good story editor. She's very, mm-hmm. very good at recognizing what does and doesn't work as far as character arcs, story goes. I'm really good at the nitpicky details, mm-hmm. like getting the contracts and the
right.
all yeah. the organizing stuff, because I like that because I'm sick. But so, yeah, because that was like, oh, don't worry about that, Gene. I'll take care of that.
I know. I was like, that's fine. I will let you take care of it. I was, you know, I felt like, okay, is he just doing that to be nice? I don't care. I'm going to say yes, go ahead.
Because let him be nice.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're both incredibly aware of each other's little chestnuts and ticks in your books. I mean, I have to say, Gene, I just hooted with delight in the new book when I came across some names I recognized yes. all too well.
Right.
So you named some characters after real
well,
people.
Well, actually, it's twofold. What I do, you know, because I work for a nonprofit healthcare agency that sees anybody. And so we have fundraisers throughout the year. And one of the things is for we do a big walk thing. And so I will auction off if you donate, you know, so much amount of money to Crescent Care, I will put your name in the book. And I've had a number of people, you know, that have stepped up and said, sure, I will do that. So it's been a lot of fun, particularly with some of the characters, people that I really know well, figuring, okay, where would they fit into this book?
Well, the bar owner with the glass of Chardonnay.
Oh, yeah. That was an obvious one.
And Greg, one of your defining characteristics, as I think of it, is just this boundless joy in the character. I mean, you do have a great cover, Royal Street Revillon. It is Jackson Square at Christmas.
Yeah, I'll admit that right now I'm reading it. And what I really love about Greg's book, The Scotty Books, is they're just fun.
Yeah.
You know, they're kind of like, oh, I've been reading this because I'm on a panel or I've been doing this or it's a Pinkley Prize or whatever. And that's a really good way to read because it takes you out. But then it's like, I want to read something fun. I want to read something I enjoy. So I said, I'm going to pick up Royal Street Revillon. And it's just such a fun time to sit there and watch these antics and see the New Orleans come through and how well you get it.
Mm-hmm. It's really funny, too, because your book is all about how hot it is in August, and mine is about how cold it is in
December.
I know.
They're like perfect bookends, I have to tell you.
I'm hot. Let me read Greg's book. Oh, I'm cold. Let me read Jean's book.
I'm in the mood for Christmas. Read both books.
Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you both so much. We've been talking with Gene Redman, whose new book is Not Dead Enough, and Greg Herron, whose new book is Royal Street Revillon, which are great reads for the holidays. Greg, Gene, thank you both.
Thank
Susan,
you
Susan, thank you.
Us.
Where are the mimosas?
Amen.
I was promised vodka.
Nabokov's Lolita, published in 1955, has been the inspiration for many popular songs. Remember Just Like That Old Man in that book by Nabokov in Sting's Don't Stand So Close to Me? The book also inspired Lolita from Lana Del Rey's second album, Born to Die, which came out in 2012.
Would you be mine? Would you be my baby tonight? Could be kissing my fruit punch lips in the bright sunshine. Cause I like you quite a lot. Everything you got, don't you know?
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, director of the New Orleans African American Museum, Gia Hamilton, will lead a discussion with Bruce Sunpie Barnes, Francis Pavey, and Charles Gillum, as well as Rachel Brenlin, about the creation of Le Cour Creole exhibit and the book of the same name, Tuesday, December 10th at 6 at the Cabildo, 701 Charters. Christopher Schaeberg discusses in Science Searching for the Anthropocene, a journey into the environmental humanities, Tuesday, December 10th at 6 at Octavia Books. John McCusker discusses in Science Giacomo, the Native Roots of Mardi Gras Indians, Tuesday, December 10th at 6:30 at the Hubble Library in Algiers. Jamie Attenberg discusses All This Could Be Yours with novelist Lady Hubbard, Thursday, December 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. Josephine Sacabo signs Structures of Reverie and Richard Sexton signs Enigmatic Stream, Saturday, December 14th at 5 at a gallery for fine photography. Danielle Del Sol, Susan Langenhannig, John Pope, and Chris Granger sign Building on the Past, Saving Historic New Orleans at the Preservation Resource Center Holiday Home Tour Boutique. That's Saturday and Sunday, December 14th and 15th, from 9:30 to 4:30 at Trinity Episcopal Church, 1329 Jackson Avenue. Tina Freeman discusses and signs Lamentations, Sunday, December 15th at 3 at Octavia Books. And if your New Year's resolution is to get serious about a writing life, check out next semester's offerings from the New Orleans Writers Workshop. Spring classes are up at neworleanswriters.com.
Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org.